Slave Operations and Reform. We're going to start off, tell you a little bit about what's going on today. We're going to hold another public hearing on the open primary bill, Senate Bill 630. We're not going to act on it today. There are amendments that are being prepared. We're going to have a special meeting at 7 o'clock on Monday morning, in which case, if the votes are here, we will be taking action on amendments and passing the bill. Things are in a state of flux, shall we say. We're also going to be holding public hearing today on Senate Joint Resolution 22 and Senate Joint Resolution 34. We're not going to be taking action on them today, but we want to hear from the sponsors of those proposals that have to do with annual sessions and have to do with the length of sessions. The chair feels that the proper time for us to actually take action on length of session and annual sessions is after we've completed this two-year experiment and hopefully completed it successfully and have built, therefore, public support. But we do want to hear the ideas that legislators have, and so we will be listening to the folks. We have Senator Devlin is coming, I assume, and Senator Gary George is already here. So since Senator George is here, why don't we go ahead and which bill is 34? Okay. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 34. And Senator George, thanks for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. Good morning. And I'm State Senator Gary George representing District 12. What you have before you today is an idea that's been talked about in the building for a long time, and that is, what do we do to put the pressure on to get us to get our work done and get out of the building? And you can see this has a time certain, and you can continue on from there, but you'll be doing it without pay. And that incentive, we believe, is a real incentive. In politics, everybody says, follow the money. Here, the money would stop. My hope as to what this will do would be to get us to look at more active, aggressive committees during the interim, and if we're able to make an annual session function, which I support, concept of an annual session, always have, the idea would be that we wouldn't just be meeting for what would be political show committees, but these committees would be active. We would be telling the agencies, basically, get your work done, get it in. I wished, if I had my druthers, could I just ramble on here with some of my ideas? If I had my druthers, they would have their own legislative council, and they would get their bills prepared so they weren't running headlong into ours, or they would have a legislator who would then represent the bill for the agency. The current system, I believe, just doesn't work. We have too many flaws in bills that should have been worked earlier. We should have had a lot of these things discussed. This system, and I don't know how many of you are aware of this thing called Linus. How many of you are aware of Linus? This is the background network in which all the agencies track what you and I are doing. And I would think that one very affirmative thing would be for all of us to be connected to Linus so we knew what they were doing. And the main thing is to have some orderly process in which we have our work prepared, and it's basically the formality of coming into session, bringing bills that are pretty well perfected before the people, and they would be able to activate according during those committees during the interim, because everyone would assume that they're really doing work during that period of time. And with that, we thought that I believe also that to put a time certain in which at least the money is going to be chopped off for the legislators. The reason that I think this is a good idea, I think it's saleable to the people, because they really don't believe we function well. And this would, I believe, send a message that we're recommending something out to you for your vote in which you can say, get your work done or you don't get paid. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Senator George? Yeah, I have a couple.
Okay.
We're going to meet the timeline, I believe, of the end of June.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly all of our goal, and not only our goal, but a mandate to do that. You're chopping another month off of that in your proposal. Do you believe that in order to meet either the timeline we have this year or your timeline, we would need to put some kind of restrictions on individual members' abilities to have 100 or more bills drafted and so on?
You know, I drafted 100 bills one session, and I'm going to tell you what, there was no question. We were trying to meet the needs of constituents. People say, well, I want to do this. I really think we need to show some restraint. If we had a limited number, it might be a smart decision. But the main thing is if we front-loaded the process with active committees during the interim that were really functioning on the basis of preparing for session, I think that would be the key. In other words, you prepared your workload before you actually arrive at the building. You've taken testimony. I've every committee that I've been in this year, we've had trouble with agency bills. How in the world could we ever have bills that should have been drafted a year and a half ago be getting in here with so many flaws and errors? So with that, I think it's going to, you know, the restructuring will be changing our attitude towards the interim committee.
Okay. And this committee is going to be holding hearings on some of those ideas on how we could streamline the whole process to make it work more efficiently, to meet narrower timelines, and then perhaps to move permanently to an every year kind of arrangement. But those things are all in flux. And the Center President has given this committee the responsibility to review some of those ideas and to make recommendations, and we will be doing that in the time that we have left. Are there other questions for Senator George? Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator, the per diem issue.
Right.
Would that be fair where you have some members that depend heavily upon that in order to provide service that maybe could be just kind of leveraged, marginalized out of the system? Because that is a critical part of, I mean, the ability to serve, that per diem is important to them.
Senator Monroe, Senator Morris, I believe that may be a perverse incentive. In other words, one of the things I'm trying to do is if you're here for the money, we probably ought to do something about that. But if you have active committees that are meeting maybe more regularly during the interim, they're going to receive additional compensation for that. I think it'll equal out at about the same number of dollars. All this idea does is let's push pressure on the end, get your work done. And my focus with the bill and with Grange's support, of course, that was a former legislator who helped to draft this, is the idea that you need incentive to get the work done during a block period of time, as other states do. And it may be a case, the Senate President has expressed similar ideas in the past, and that is it may be not quite try to get the work done in 30 days, maybe 60 days, but in other words, lengthen out the second regular session. The annual session, the second annual session, to level that out just a little bit. But the idea being is that once you get down into June, people start to wonder, what are we doing? Why were you not prepared that you couldn't get your work done and get out of the building?
And when you got down into August, it was even worse.
Thank you, Senator, Senator Monroe, is that once you reach June and you get into July, it does only go downhill. I mean, we get on each other's nerves. You all know that. And it gets down to many times just party politics, bickering. And instead of trying to get the will of the people done and get good policy in place and get out of here. Because so many times I really am afraid that we still today, and I applaud this committee's action, today I still believe that too many times we're doing things not on the basis of policy, but on the basis of politics. And I think that we've matured enough that we can now say, okay, look, it's policy and policy only. I've had people say to me, Gary, I've seen you on certain sides this year that I didn't expect you to be on, and it's because of the policy. If the policy's good, I don't care whose idea it is. That's where I want to be, is where good policy is. And when it comes to efficiency and agency, people can say, well, that's not the responsibility of the legislature, but I say, yes, it is. Who do our employees go to if it's not to us, if they have a problem or a solution?
Senator Atkinson has a question.
Thank you. More of a statement to that last question, Senator George. I've been a fan of hard end dates for a very long time, and have voted for bills like this for a long time. I think the solution just for our policy is hard indents. The per diem thing is that's less certain. If everybody knows on certain day that everything is dead, it's over, finished. I think one of the things we've all experienced this year from the Senate President is knowing that on June 29th we're done. It's forced the entire legislature to back calendar when bills are going to go through. And so that's not a partisan thing. That's just a time management. That's a good benefit of time management. And we all know that on July we're not here. I think pressure is a wonderful thing, that we have allowed some pressures to be applied to the legislature that are not healthy, and some without hard end dates that are actually really, really bad. So I think more of a statement, but hard end dates is the solution, where at a certain point, everything is just dead, over. Sign and die.
Very good.
Anything else? Senator George, thank you so much for coming at this early hour. Appreciate your input.
I know where the worms are gone when I go out looking for them later in the day. You guys have them. So, beautiful drive-in, by the way, so good to be with you.
Thank you. Okay, is there anybody else that wanted to be heard on Senate Joint Resolution 34? If not, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 34 and open a public hearing on Senate Joint Resolution 22 and call on Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Mr. Chairman, do you have time for me to recall a little bit of history and a little bit of background?
Of course.
Okay.
I think you should qualify that before you agree.
Well, within reason, we do have to be finished in an hour. So,
in terms of some of the discussions about annual versus biennial sessions, some of the shortcomings of biennial sessions that are often identified, and I'll just go through these briefly, is that the biennial format is unsuitable for dealing with the complex and continuing problems that confront today's legislatures. I think we have all seen issues similar to that in our tenure. Annual sessions make it more co-equal branch of government. I think that's an issue that the Senate President has highlighted a number of times in terms of restoring the equality of the legislative branch in our three tiers of government. It also allows something that we often don't talk about here, and that is legislative oversight of the executive branch. Clearly a more capability to do that than if you're just meeting biennially. I know that Representative Morris has his expression that he'll inform to you all what it means, the you be, we be. He can inform that later to you, what that means. I recall a certain representative a number of years ago, and this is just one of many examples, who had passed a bit of legislation that impacted the Corrections Division. It was actually even funded. Came back the next session, and the Corrections Division's response, so I don't in any way tend to impugn Mr. Williams's character, was not Mr. Williams at the time, said, we just didn't have time to do it. That was their response. And that's about as much reaction as he got out of the administration also. Also, the states may respond more rapidly to changes in federal law and changing circumstances, and also that the legislature cannot operate effectively in fits and starts. That's because sometimes the few legislatures that are left that meet biennially often spend a lot of time in special sessions. Plus, I think there's a common issue in terms of if you have annual sessions. Some people believe that since they're shorter, you would not have the same amount of time to deal with issues. The reality, though, is that you would be far more familiar on an ongoing basis with those issues. So, for instance, while some people may feel it'd be difficult to get through our budget process in 120 days, which is a relatively normal length for the long session in an annual sessions format, if you have committee members that have been just reviewing the budget a number of months before, their familiarity is quite a bit different than if you start all over again every 2 years. And some of the history of annual sessions, in the 1960s, only 19 state legislatures met annually. The remaining 31 held biennial regular sessions. All but three, Kentucky, Mississippi, and Virginia, held their biennial sessions in the odd-numbered year. 10 of the 19 states with annual sessions limited the off year to consideration of budget and fiscal matters. By the mid-1970, the number of states annually grew tremendously, up from 19 to 41 states. However, several of these states used a flexible session format in which the total days of session time was divided between 2 years. These states include Minnesota, North Carolina, Tennessee, and Vermont. Should comment, too, that a number of states have formats, which I'm not actually advocating, where they have like a 120-day period for their session, but they have 35 or 40 legislative days during that are already pre-scheduled. Today, however, 44 states meet annually. The remaining six states, Arkansas, Montana, Nevada, North Dakota, Oregon, and Texas, hold session every other year. All of the biennial legislatures hold their regular session in the odd year. Six states have limited scope sessions that have annual sessions. Those states with limited scope sessions in their annual sessions are Connecticut, Louisiana, Maine, New Mexico, North Carolina, and Wyoming. Now, if I could just briefly recall just the most recent history of annual sessions in this chamber. In 1990, voters narrowly rejected the annual session approach. I believe it had been referred by the legislature, I think by a couple of thousand votes, to be honest. They turned it down. 1995, House Joint Resolution 40, sponsored by Representative Bev Clarno, passed both the Senate and the House. However, the two chambers could not come into agreement on it. 1997, Senate Joint Resolution 34, sponsored by Senator Randy Miller, passed both the Senate and the House, and once again, both houses would not concur on the amendments. In 1999, Senate Joint Resolution 15, sponsored again by Senator Miller, passed the Senate and was recommended to pass by the House Rules Committee. It was in the possession of the Speaker at sine die. 2001 was one of the few sessions where nothing much advanced on annual sessions. SJR 18 was again introduced by Senator Miller, but it actually was referred to the Rules Committee and remained there upon adjournment. In 2003, I'd been working with both Senator Miller and Senator Representative Edwards in previous sessions on annual sessions, but of course both of those left. So I sponsored SJR 11. It passed the Senate 20-10, the most bipartisan vote I think I've ever seen. 10 Republicans yes, 10 Democrats yes. 5 Democrats no, 5 Republicans no. Of course, it never went anywhere. I think it had a courtesy hearing on the House side, but that was about it. 2005, I sponsored SJR 9. It passed out of the Senate by a 25-4 vote. I don't want to speak for her, but the one party that was excused that day was Senator Winters, and Senator Winters has a history of favoring these, so it could have probably been 26-4. This year I'm sponsoring SJR 22. I'm not anticipating that the bill will actually pass out this session since we're in this sort of experiment process, but I just wanted to get an opportunity to get some of these issues before this committee because I think they're very important. And really, the benefits of annual sessions don't come from just limiting the length of a biennial session. All those things that I identified at the beginning, you don't really have those benefits if you simply limit the length of the biennial session. I have noticed one thing in our course of events here during this session, and I think it's went relatively well. But I think it's going to take some time for people to come accustomed to not shorter time frames in terms of deadlines, because our actual deadlines in terms of bill introductions, in terms of getting out of chambers, are actually as long or longer than we've ever had before. But the idea is getting this work compact within a certain period of time. Everybody that I talk to that has an issue with this thinks it's so difficult. Well, if it's so difficult, I'd like to know why 44 states, with the exception of three, there are actually three full-time legislatures, maybe four. But why all these states? Some of them do it in 90 days, some of them do it in 60, some do it in 120. Many do it in their off-year session in 45 or 60, and a few as little as 30 days. Why we are so unique that we can't do it within that time frame. But I do think that the experiment that we've done this session is beneficial because it's allowed us to start to think about how to get all of our work done in a reasonable period of time. There is an issue that's presented because we're not taking action now of when we would take action. And I think some people, I know that the speaker, I have not heard an official statement from the Senate president, have talked about referring this out to the people in the next regular legislative session in 2009. That begs the question of what you do in 2009 biennium. I would suggest that what you should do is similar to what you have done this session. However, I would suggest that you limit it even further. Not the deadlines necessarily, but to contract the session a little bit more. Get the people more accustomed to completing their work within a reasonable period of time. By doing that, I think when we go to annual sessions, and if we're presuming we are successful in these sessions, I think you will have a very orderly transition. I think members need to become accustomed to this, public needs to become accustomed to this, lobby needs to become accustomed to this, and quite honestly, state government needs to become accustomed to this, that we have a limited period of time. To give you an idea, not to create any fears in your mind, if we were under Senate Bill or SGR 22 right now, we would be adjourning sine die. Not this coming Sunday, but the Sunday after that.
Well, thank you very much. Are there questions for Senator Devlin? Thank you. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Senator, for that rather complete commentary about what other states do. You and I have served on Ways and Means. How do you see the budget process changing in order to meet these timelines? Because we would be starting to wrap things up pretty tightly here under this scenario.
I think how they would change is, I think, and one of the things people need to think about is how familiar people would become with the budget. While we would be probably signing dying in May in the under this scenario, in the odd number year, we would be coming back again the following January. So the period of time between this is not particularly long, and I think people would be more familiar, and so that would lead to, in Senator Schrader's words, less dog and pony shows and actually more just focusing directly on budget issues. I think, though, there are a couple of issues, and some of those you don't really deal with in annual sessions bills that you're proposing, because once you start to propose process things, it gets to be a little bit difficult, because I think those things are things that should be discussed broadly. But I may be straying a little bit here, but I'm just trying to say that just because you go to annual sessions does not mean you go to annual budgets. Many states that have annual sessions have biennial budgets. A lot do have annual budgets, but you could stay with biennial budgets. There are a few states, actually, I think at least one of them, I'll have to check, that have a biennial session that actually produce two annual budgets. They don't actually produce the biennial budget. So there's really, that decision is something that would have to be discussed, what you would do in terms of the length of budgeting. And obviously, in terms of if we went from biennial to annual budgeting, there would be a lot of issues to address. But I think, quite honestly, I think there's a real benefit. I hate to compare legislators in any way to, maybe I'll compare them to university students. That doesn't sound as offensive. But university students lose a lot in between spring term and fall term. I was going to say third graders lose a lot between spring term and fall term, but that would be offensive. I think the familiarity that you have with annual sessions, coming back in and dealing with these issues in detail, keeps the legislature abreast of the issues, both policy issues and budget issues. I just think that there's so many examples of people that can do this and do it well, actually, in many cases, that I don't see the shorter session being really an impediment to having a good budget process.
Just might follow up.
Go ahead,
Mr. Chair. my reflections on the budget process is there is a lot of motion without much outcome. We hold hearings. I believe we actually waste the taxpayers' money with agencies, with the energy and time and money that they put into preparing for budget hearings. I think that we would naturally transition, which I would very much support, into a system of budgets by exception, and you put more responsibility on your legislative fiscal staff. If there's a budget that looks like they've got a problem, then we hold hearings for them. But those agencies, and there are eyes and ears in the interim and during the session, you know, they're tracking these agencies, and if there are no issues with an agency, wrap those budgets up into one budget bill. You might have 30 or 40 agencies into one budget bill. You know, things are not a problem, but I can see us fundamentally changing the way that we do the budget. It, you know, there's a lot of time and energy with very little.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
very little positive outcome.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morse, if I can, Senator Morse and I have had both similar experiences outside just one in the Education Committee. We have about 14, 15 small licensing commissions. I think I was able to get that down to about 7 or 8 days last session. I think we had close to a little bit more than 2 weeks on them this session. Those are all other funds. They are all actually fees being paid by the people that are governed by them. I'm not saying that they don't deserve review, but when you consider the fact that we spent about 2.5 weeks on those and we spent about 1 week on the state school fund, that's a little bit disproportionate oversight between those two.
Senator George, you want to pipe in on this?
Are you seeing me fidgeting back
there? Is that okay with you?
Yes.
Okay, thanks. Since the two of us are in agreement on annual sessions.
Uh-huh. Again, for the record?
For the record, State Senator Gary George, District 12. I totally agree with what Senator Morris has said, Mr. Chairman. But one of the deficiencies I think we see, and that's not just Senator Morrison, I'm sure that's Senator Devlin also. We need some sort of audits division within the legislative branch. Senator Morris proposed several bills. I have a bill basically mimicking the Texas Sunset Commission with a set of auditors. We did this in the past. We have two lobbyists who worked the buildings who actually were members of that committee that went through and audited agency. If you think about the combination of the Secretary of State's audits and ours being primarily targeted towards the idea of efficiency and product delivery, in my estimation, that's the only way we're going to be able to get in deep into the budgets and find out what's going on. I'm very frustrated to be sitting in Transportation Ways and Means, realizing that in 2003, I chaired that committee. We're hearing the exact same reports from the agencies when we gave them instructions in certain areas to take care of a certain problem, and we're back with the problem being as bad or worse than it was before. There needs to be interim activity to scrutinize the instructions from the legislature to the executive branch to get things done. I mean, for some reason, the people gave us control of the budget. Do we really have control of the budget? I don't believe we do.
Okay. Senator Bakken.
I am... part of this discussion has to do with process within the Ways and Means Committee, but tying it back to annual sessions, I think just having the legislature having a strong presence in the Capitol building once a year is something that will lend itself to a tighter rein on those agency budgets, just in and of itself.
I think it would. Mr. Chairman, if I might say, it's only my personal preference right now based upon my understanding of the budget process, but I think transitioning to an annual budget would be something that would be long-term and should be really thought, a great deal of thought should go into whether we do that. I think at first if we went to annual sessions, we should stay with a biennial budget, review it extensively during the odd-numbered year, but come back in the even-numbered year basically to tweak the budget and to look at the issues that we had identified and see if they had been addressed since we had approved the budget, or at least that the agency has attempted to address them.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Senator George?
On this idea of us having a team of auditors who, in fact, reflect the viewpoint of the elected legislators as far as going in and auditing, particularly for performance. We've had so many projects that have failed us, and just the other day in the committee I mentioned on transportation, ways and means, I asked the question of the person heading up DMV. I said, I had a SEIU member come by, and we were talking, and I've been exchanging with this person over what I've seen as efficiencies and the lack of computer capacity inside of DMV. And the person told me that, Gary, our estimate is not the $123.9 million estimate that the Secretary of State's office had, but probably when you add in all of the inefficiencies, best that the union has been able to determine, we're looking at $300 to $400 million of additional costs, not considering the amazing amount of costs we would have put onto the backs of the taxpayers and users of DMV as they come into an office that is inefficient because it doesn't have computer capacity. And when I asked the question of the director responded back, you're talking about time loss and inefficiency? Yeah. Well, everything total. It could be $300 to $400 million. Now, I'm sitting here looking at everyone else who has caught up and put in place. My office has been working on using open source Linux type of software to get computer software development into development outside of the strict structure of certain companies' development rights. And I think the benefit to that is that you're going to be able to quickly move an agency into more service delivery. I think that's just one small example. I think there's a lot of other examples like that in which if we had the ability to go in and audit, we would then be able to determine what direction we might take. Because I ask in that committee, what are we going to do about this? I only see $1.9 million in your budget for IT. Is that going to do it? It wasn't going to do it. Did we know that we hadn't solved the problem? Not really. We didn't know that. So I hope, can I get a read from you guys? I mean, do you guys have thoughts about an auditor? If not, I'll just take my idea and just put it away. I know I'm not supposed to be asking you questions, but I thought this dialogue was great.
If we're not careful, we're going to get the former Secretary of State up here, and he's going to pull off the gloves.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Devlin, and then we're going to have to move on.
Mr. Chairman, if I might comment, I think sometimes there's an issue of semantics, and I don't believe maybe that Senator George would agree with me in this. Well, I might have some disagreements about the state having a direct legislative audit function. I do believe we are woefully understaffed in legislative fiscal. To give you an idea of that is that I have, for education, for all of education, two analysts. 55% of the state budget, two analysts. One does all primary and secondary, and one does all post-secondary. I believe DHS, has two analysts. We do some of the same things with the analysts that we actually do with the committee itself. We have analysts that are devoting a great deal of time to relatively small budgets with few issues simply because we have to take them through this cumbersome process. I think we need a combination of more focusing those resources in LFO on the budgets that where there are real issues, but we actually need more staff in LFO too so that we can, maybe not an audit function, but where we can clearly explore some of the issues in those budgets. I think beyond those two staff people and the legislative members that we have who, all legislative members, I hate to tell you this, are all sort of transitory. They're here for a while and then gone.
Someone come back.
Yeah. if we lose those two staff members in LFO, either for education or for human services, we've lost an immense portion of our legislative history.
Thank you. Senator Atkinson.
I would answer Senator George's question. I think I would agree. We do need not only audit, but research. And to Senator Devlin, I think the conversation is now taken into a different place, which addresses the rust that's on the legislative branch of government. We are the weakest branch of government by a mile. The building, as you all, as this committee knows, is a reflection of how weak we perceive ourselves. One senator who represents twice as many people as a state representative, many of us have one staff person to do all that constituent work, and we have no help when it comes to research or audit functions. So I would agree with you, but I think that it's more, as this committee has discussed, it's more the rust and the complete weakness we have on the legislative branch that has got us to here, and that should be remedied.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple of observations listening to your comment. And I agree with Senator Avakian in terms of kind of ways and means process as well. I recall in 99 when I joined the legislature and as a minority member and was assigned to Ways and Means, which upset a lot of veterans in my caucus that the freshman went to Ways and Means and it was supposed to be some kind of plum job, and I thought it was, the, no offense, Senator Devlin, one of the most boring things I've done in my legislative deal, watching slideshows. But again, as you pointed out in seriousness, Senator Avakian, that's our internal process of what we allow to do and how do we manage getting to the core of issues in terms of the budget process. And from what I've seen as I walk by those rooms, it's kind of the same way now, despite all the talk about how we're reforming Ways and Means. I still see the same thing going on and glad I'm doing policy and not doing that. But I think the real point is, and you've touched on this, Senator Devlin, as well as others, is, and Chairman Monroe, as we talk about the legislature reform and our function and what the President has often said about our role in government, it does reflect our investment in staff in terms of fiscal, in terms of legislative counsel, and then our directions to them, because in a sense, like any administrative hierarchy, you have the different levels, and at the ultimate, we're empowered and charged with making decisions for our district and for our state. But it is the people doing, we can't physically do all that work or have that expertise. We have to be able to build that into our system so we make the right decisions. And if we just don't have the staff doing that, then we go through this process all the time, as opposed to looking at investing in staff, giving them the proper matrix to evaluate what we think is important in various agencies. So when we come into the session, we have the answers, for the most part, that we have already articulated that we need for us to make decisions. And so our investment in that and then providing the right direction to able staff to say, this is what I want to know about these agencies because I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. I'm going to rely on the directions I've given you to find out, I think is a real critical part. And as you are well aware, the state of Washington, which has an over $40 billion state budget, they adjourned on Sunday. That's their regular time. And they've made those investments. They have procedures in place so that they're not having to do all those dog and pony shows. They know the answers that they've asked for when they start in January and they get down to making policy decisions. And so I think a lot of it's within our own control as to how we want to manage this process and the investments that we want to make to maintain the legislative role of our three-tier government and be efficient and do it well. And I think as we make decisions on budgets and invest in the personnel and give them direction, I think that's where our time management is going to be most efficient, and looking at the model from that standpoint rather than trying to tweak a model of endless sessions in which there's basically no direction.
And we'll let that be the final word on this. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your input. We do have Kathy Eaton, who wants to comment from the League of Women Voters.
On annual sessions into keeping the grounds clean.
Kathy, welcome.
Thank you, Senator Morris, members of the committee. If For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. League, as you know, is a nonpartisan grassroots organization that encourages participation in government. We appreciate this opportunity to talk to you because the League has had its position on annual, in support of annual sessions, for 27 years now. And we have participated as possible when in the history that Senator Devlin gave you with those efforts to finally get annual sessions. Looking at the League's history with this, there were four elements that caused the League to come, the members to come to the decision that we needed annual sessions. It has to do with the budgeting. It has to do with the response time that's necessary for what happens in the world that we live in. It has to do with accountability. It has to do with efficiency. And our members felt, and they still do, that annual sessions of the legislature, with the state that we have that's growing, with the size budget that we have now, we really do need annual sessions. The impetus of annual sessions, I think, we'll find out when you have your first try at it in 2008. That should give us some information about how it will work, a short session. We are really concerned, and we were for almost 30 years ago, about the fact that, remember that this is the League of Women Voters. We budget for our households. And having a budget that's decided 26 months ahead of time and trying to work with that is, just think about it, but we think about it and find that it's impossible to budget realistically and appropriately for a budget that you decide 2 years in the future, and we know what happens often with those kinds of budgets. So having the ability to review that budget every year, we feel makes a whole lot of sense. Whether or not you move it this session, and I agree with Senator Devlin, we probably need to have the experience of an annual session next time, but we would hope that before too long, the voters would have a chance to discuss and to vote on this. We think people are ready to talk about it. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy. We appreciate your input. At this, is there anybody else that wanted to be heard on Senate Joint Resolution 22? No, we'll close the public hearing. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 630. Senate Bill 630, we have amendments from Senator Courtney. Marjorie, you want to?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 630 is the open primary bill. However, you have the dash one amendment attached to the staff measure summary. That dash one amendment replaces the measure and requires county clerks to send a ballot to non-affiliated voters for those parties that have opened their primary to those non-affiliated voters. If more than one party has opened their primary to non-affiliated voters, then the voter is required to notify the county clerk which ballot they wish to receive. And I did confirm yesterday afternoon from the Elections Division that at this time, parties do have the authority to open their primaries to non-affiliated voters.
So Senator Courtney's amendment simply would facilitate what is already legal. Is that correct, Marjorie?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that's my understanding.
Okay. Senator Courtney?
Well, I don't know what you just said. First of all, I'm in a rush because let me just finish. I'm in a rush. I put myself on two legislative committees, and since I'm the guy that's having to enforce the April 30th deadline, I'm supposed to be in another committee starting at 8 o'clock to help them get bills out to meet that deadline. And as I'm finding, the April 30th deadline is a very difficult deadline to enforce in terms of my fellow senators who continually visit my office and ask for exceptions. This is not my, it's not my understanding, what you just said. My understanding is, because this was attempted before, and I was very unhappy about how it was handled, if the Democratic Party chooses to open a primary, which I urged them to do and got them to do, and the Republican Party chose not to do that, then in a Democratic primary, all voters in Oregon would receive a ballot, the Democratic, all of them, not just some of them, all of them. That's the way it would happen. You wouldn't have to request the ballot. The Democratic primary is truly open to all Oregonians who are registered to vote. It's not what happened last time. They made them have to call in or request in, so not a single person requested the ballot. So I am told by legislative council, this clearly makes it so, I'm not going to make noise like a lawyer, that the Democratic Party, through their state process, chooses to open their ballot. Then the next primary, if, for example, I was on the ballot, anybody who was registered to vote in the state of Oregon would have a shot at me in the primary. Where it gets interesting is, if the Republican Party joins the Democratic Party, then to be very upfront with all of you, we're back in the situation we were in when Randy Miller and I tried this 100,000 years ago. That's where the individual would have to request a ballot saying which ballot they want, which is not unlike some other states that you're now reading down here who have a modified version of it. The Republican Party, for some reason, 10 years ago, or was it 12 years ago, I don't know how long, did not choose to open their primary. My view of primary is, you know, whether the Olympians, who's going to choose the American Olympic team, who's going to choose the Western Oregon University captain, I see the primary different than other people see the primary. So I'm for it. You let the parties decide you want to open their primary. And I would urge my party, if this would become law, to open their primary. I did it before. I'd do it again. Open your primary. That's what the measure is. That's what the amendment does. It was developed by Ruttlinger.
Okay, and Marjorie, the amendments that are being drafted for Monday morning, what would they do?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, we are requesting approval for that additional meeting on Monday morning, and I was told by members to go fix the legal problems. So at this point, I am referring to the letter that accompanied the Legislative Council draft for Senate Bill 53, and my assumption is that those requesters of Senate Bill 630 received the identical letter from Ted Reutlinger. Apparently, when Senate Bill 53 was drafted, we based that draft on Initiative 86. However, we deleted Section 10, Sub 3 of Initiative 86, which would authorize the parties to acknowledge the membership of a candidate in a particular party. So Ted Reutlinger suggested that perhaps we might need to add Section 10, Sub 3 back to the measure, and so that's my initial request. And then at the request of the chair, I was told to add a provision to the measure that allows a candidate who wins 50% or more in a primary in a partisan election, that they would actually win the election. That currently applies in the bill to nonpartisan offices. So we would make it apply to partisan offices also.
And that is a suggestion from both the vice chair and the chair of this committee, that if you get a majority in the primary, in a contested partisan primary, get a majority, then you win. Senator Avakian.
That statement is made on the assumption that the open primary would pass, either as the bill is now or with the amendment that the president said. But if it were not to pass, you're not contemplating in something outside this bill.
Absolutely not. Okay. Absolutely not.
So the primary election becomes the general election.
Which it is in.
That's what you've done in effect.
Essentially, yes, unless there are more than two candidates and nobody gets a majority in the primary, then they go to a runoff. The November election becomes a runoff. As we all know, currently in the majority of legislative districts, the primary election determines who the next legislator will be. There are several districts that are evenly balanced where a Republican or a Democrat can be elected, but in the majority of districts that tilt pretty heavily either D or tilt pretty heavily R, if you win the primary, you're in.
Mr. Chair, I didn't articulate my question very well. If the President's amendment were to be adopted, then I don't understand how what you said would apply, because you could have the situation where, for instance, the Democrats...
It would not apply.
Okay.
We have two different ways to go here. We have the way that's outlined by Senator Courtney. We have the way that is preferred by the commission and Senator Morse and myself. And the question also arises on whether or not Senator Winters will be able to join us on Monday morning, because if she's not able to join us, then we will still meet, but the only amendments that would be viable, I would think, at that time would be Senator Courtney's. And I can't speak for Senator Winters. I know Senator Morse is working with her, and we'll just have to see where we are on that. I told people months ago that if you show me 4 votes on this committee and 16 votes on the floor of the Senate, I will try to help you get an open primary bill out. That's where I stand. Okay, we have a witness that wanted to testify on open primary. Mr. Hofford, please come forward.
Just, my name's Don Hofford, and I'm a Democrat. I'll state that up front. And I live in Loa, Oregon. I was an economist for the Bonneville Power Administration, doing forecast economics, and was a division director at the Bonneville Power Administration. I guess that's enough. And I went to the University of Oregon and got a master's degree in economics. So anyway, I have some knowledge of these of the subjects. But anyway, I guess just to comment on the it's kind of a nitpicking thing about the amendments. And basically, it says on page 4, it says if the elector has applied for a ballot. They're talking about non-affiliates here. And I guess my assumption is they're probably going to get about 10% response. Well, the fact that they don't even know about it, for one thing, and the fact that they have to initiate the contact. I guess I would recommend that you or either the county clerk or the secretary of state or something send out a card to the non-affiliates and say, these are your options. You can, and there may be two chances, a Republican or a Democrat. And also, I would add a third, which is maybe consistent with the philosophy of an independent or a person that's non-affiliated, and that is none of the above. I mean, some people, I know a few independents, and basically they feel that they don't want to be associated with any political party. And giving them, just sending them a ballot, and let's say that's a Democratic ballot, they may be a very conservative Republican in philosophy anyway, and they may be offended by getting a ballot of a Democratic Party when they can't stand the Democratic Party. Do you see what I mean? And so basically I would say, telling them their options, providing a card that they can sign, send back to the Secretary of State or whoever, and then giving them the option of deciding to vote or not to vote in that primary election. I guess I think that's probably pretty easy to correct, I think. I guess I have some other comments as well. And that's basically, I think the independent voters, and the reason why they're independent voters, is because they would like to choose their candidates on the basis of who they like, not based on party affiliation. And they would prefer to do what's called a crossover vote or something. And in other words, sending them all the ballots and then go ahead and you know, for the governor's race, they pick the Democrats, in the senatorial race, they pick the Republican. I mean, that's what they want to do. And that's the reason why they elected to be independent to begin with. So I think, in a sense, you're kind of missing the point about who these people are. And that's just kind of my reaction in reading the bill or the amendments to the bill.
Well, you're arguing for Senate Bill 630 the way it currently is written.
I'm just going by what the amendment was here.
Yeah, well, the way the bill is currently written, people would get one ballot which would have all R's and D's and everybody else on it and could choose who they wanted to vote for.
Yeah. Well, but it doesn't say that in the...
Not in the amendments.
Amendments, no. Okay. I'm commenting on
amendments
right now.
Yeah, and the amendments to 630 are not prepared yet.
Yeah. Well, I got the...
You have Senator Courtney's amendments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I was commenting on that. I guess the other things related to that is... I guess I didn't see any... I'm not familiar with the other provisions. I was just looking at the amendments.
Well, the bill as written is a yeah. Open primary.
Okay. Then I'll reserve my comments on the open primary itself. However, I do have some suggestions that, and I have 20 copies here.
Oh, okay. Good.
That if that's okay. Now, I guess I have some. Well, I guess the. The amendments I applaud in the sense that it provides the parties with more power. I mean, basically, I don't mean power, but there are a lot of concerns about an open primary being taking away the powers of the parties, you might say. And these amendments do not do that, and they kind of... allows the parties to make some decisions and who votes in their primary. But anyway, on the thing, everybody have that? Basically, I would say this is what I would propose. It's not quite a open primary,
but has some of the same
characteristics as it. And basically, let's look down at the assumptions. This example that's below here is that all parties must participate in the primary. In other words, even nonpartisan. And I assume the open bill has the same provision, and so I agree with that. All independent candidates must also participate in the primaries, and I think that's the open bill, is open primaries consistent with that. And all registered voters vote in their primaries only, not an open primary. It's basically a party system, which includes the, and I guess the, and number four is the independent voters or non-affiliated voters can vote for only the non-affiliated candidates. In other words, there'll be a slate of non-affiliated candidates, and they are allowed to vote in those. And of course, if the party wants them to allow them to vote in another primary, they can do that as well, but which is consistent with your amendment. And I guess I would make a couple of other assumptions, and which is called the instant voter runoffs. You know, one of the problems with the elections is, well, I think there's three problems. One is the non-affiliated voters, which is the independents, and you guys have addressed that, and it's very well. And even assuming in the open primary, the non-affiliated or the minor parties are also included, so you've addressed both of those. However, and I assume that the open primary has only two candidates moving on to the general election. Is that okay? I would say, in my proposal, I would say all of the parties move on to the general election, and let's go through the Republican ballot here. And I put down a instant runoff ballot, you might say, so that person can make selections of preferences, and in which you can help determine a winner. Let's say that in this Republican ballot here, that Smith is a very conservative, and Jones, Hoffman, and Johnson are all moderates in the Republican Party anyway. And if you had a if you did not have a instant runoff ballot, perhaps Smith, the more conservative Republican, would be elected. However, if you had an instant runoff thing, maybe one of the other candidates would actually win the primary instead of the more conservative candidate. Or, and it also goes the other way, you have three conservatives and one liberal. So anyway, it helps to provide a better mechanism for the so the Republicans can choose the party that they choose.
Questions?
I'm trying to go fast here, so
Senator Biden has a question.
I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying here. What's the significance of your second and third choices?
I just voted here just to show you what people could do by voting.
No, I mean, if you mark down Joe Hoffman.
I'm sorry, I thought most people were familiar with the. Let's say that to determine the winner, and that basically the you first take off the one with the lowest vote count. That person is eliminated, and it goes to their second vote. Let's say that Hoffman was eliminated on the first round because Joe didn't get enough votes. Let's say one of the other ones. And then they actually would look at that person's second choice. Let's say this candidate here let's say Smith is eliminated, let's say, because he didn't get enough votes. Then Smith, this person that voted on here, his vote would actually be instantly transferred to Hoffman.
To a second choice.
To a second choice.
Right. So
if you're eliminated, if this person, this candidate, this person that voted here, if his first choice is eliminated, it goes to its second choice.
It's an instant runoff system is what it's usually
referred to. Yeah, it's an instant runoff system. But anyway, this is not... I don't think it's the spoiler system in the party primaries is not a serious problem. But there are, some people might think there is. But anyway, this is an option, you might say. And also, I also put down the candidates, and these are really non-affiliated candidates, and then the independents would vote on the ballot as well there. Okay, now let's go to the general election. And of course, it's an instant runoff too, but that's a kind of gravy, you know. Okay, in the general election, in assumption 7 and 8 is that only one candidate from each party, including the non-affiliated so-called, let's say, party, or it's treated like a party, would go on to the general election. And I'm also using the instant runoff provisions under the general election. Okay, in this case, there would be more candidates, and I've kind of listed a few of them on there. And then I made a standard ballot. I want to point out that to be totally fair, you have to have one less column across than number of voters. So in this case, we have five candidates. You need four to be a perfect election. However, that kind of complicates things, and I would suggest only three would be sufficient. And if possible, it may be that if a person is eliminated, they may not their vote may not count. And I guess my comments about just the open primary in general is that this provision maintains the party integrity. There is some constitutional issues associated with the open primary, as probably a lot of you already know. I mean, you guys are the lawyers. I'm an economist. So, but anyway, I have done some reading about the open primary, and I guess if you're going to pass an open primary, I would probably put in a stopgap or an alternative or an alternative strategy, because there is some possibilities that the open primaries may not survive the this current Supreme Court. So anyway, that's just a kind of like I say, I'm not a lawyer, but I have done extensive reading about.
I'm not a lawyer either. I'm a teacher.
Yeah, well, anyway.
Thank you very much. We're going to need to move on. We only have about 5 minutes left, and Mr. Kiesling wanted to make a few remarks.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and all the rest of you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for allowing me to testify.
And Phil, would you have just a few minutes? So.
Respect that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Phil Kiesling, 3408 Southeast 8th. I want to first speak to the amendments that I just saw this morning from Senator Courtney. I think what he stated as his intent is not in alignment with what these amendments actually do. These amendments simply affect non-affiliated voters, about 25%. If the intent is for the Democrats to say we want to let any voter, including registered Republicans, get a Democratic ballot, this would not accomplish it. I also think there would be some very serious constitutional issues with that. But I just wanted to point that out. I also want to point out that basically, as the chair noted, this is a complete replacement. This really has nothing to do with an open primary. This has to do with an existing primary in which parties that may decide to allow non-affiliated voters in, it would facilitate the process. Exactly right. If one does, everyone would get the ballot. But if both do, you're back into the situation. I have to request it in writing. And when we did this in the 90s, and both parties did, the participation was, shall we say, pretty underwhelming.
Well, both parties didn't, only the Democrats.
No, the Republicans did at one cycle as well, back in 1992 when Craig Berkman was chair of the party. And you had to request, you could request the ballot right then and there on the site, which actually is easier than it is in a vote-by-mail situation, but very few did. So I would imagine very few would participate in it. I think that is a fundamental policy choice for this committee if you want to go with the Courtney amendments, but recognize what it does and what it doesn't do. Let me speak real briefly to the issue of constitutionality issues in Section 10.3 and the amendments that the chair has talked about. I point out that really that Section 33 is the only section that memo raises that constitutional issue with, and it has to do with listing the registration status of candidates on the ballot, member of blank party. Now, in Measure 86, we dealt with this very straightforwardly. We had an explicit severability clause. If Section 33, if 254.115, Section 2, would be declared unconstitutional for a voter choice office, you simply wouldn't have the party labels listed. Everything else would survive. Now, we put 10.3 in there because we think voters want information about a public record. It's a public record what people are registered as. And yes, there's a cloud, although I'll note that the U.S. Supreme Court, by taking the Washington case, has in many people's mind raised the possibility that they disagree with the lower court decision, and then this language is less likely to get thrown out. But assume there is a potential problem. I'd argue the easiest, cleanest way to deal with it for purposes of the bill going forward is to just simply explicitly sever that one far and away most problematic section, and then have a default be candidates can talk about their party registration, they can talk about it in the voter's pamphlet, but it would be left blank on the ballot. Now, I don't like that. That's why we put 10-3 in. But I would say if you're not comfortable with putting 10-3 in, maybe just do a severability on it. And the final point I'll just note about the 50% plus one, terminology is important in this because of constitutional issues and the others. This is not winning in a partisan election. This would refer to voter choice elections. This bill would leave three categories of elections, nonpartisan, voter choice, and partisan. Still leaves the possibility of partisan elections. You just have to explicitly say this is a partisan election. So if the intent is in a voter choice office to not have a top two but allow an outright win in the May primary, that would be the language that the amendment should use as voter choice. Now, personally, I don't think that's anywhere near as strong. Going to top two and giving voters a chance to look at it, I think, makes them more comfortable. We did a polling on this issue, and it was very strongly supportive, kind of a second look. The turnout in the primary will not be as high as it will in a general. There's an expectation that people have that these offices, governor, senator, big offices, there's an expectation that they're going to be on the ballot in November, and it's kind of, why, what happened? Well, I actually decided it in May. I also point out that there's a choice that you would make if you do decide you want to do this. Do you proceed, do you declare the election over, or do you simply advance the one name to the November ballot, which, of course, when you do that, always leaves open the possibility of a write-in candidacy. And when we did the top two, we recognized very clearly that we did not change the ability to have a write-in candidacy in November. A candidate could die or withdraw who was in the top two and nobody else would take their place. Some really strange things could happen. So when you do craft that, if that is what you want to do to move the bill forward, I think I would, you know, be cognizant of that distinction. Declare the election over versus the one name goes to the election. Any other questions I can help answer on this as you move forward? Obviously, I very strongly support Senate Bill 630. Believe as written, it's an extraordinarily good piece of public policy, but I know it's a matter of 4 and 16.
Mr. Kiesling, I suggested, first of all, if we're going to do an open primary, I want to make sure that the candidates are listed with their party.
Yes.
I think that's very, very important. And, in fact, if we can't do it that way, then I'm not interested.
Well, that's why I think 10-3 with severability, and there may be some tweaks with 10-3, and I'd be happy to work with the committee administrator and both of you to suggest some things that might be more comfortable.
I even suggested the possibility. There was some question about whether or not the candidates would be certified by the party, which troubles me because sometimes party leaders don't necessarily reflect the rank and file voters. I suggested perhaps that if a person has been registered as a member of a political party for 6 months or more, then they can file for that office and use that label.
Senator, I was literally sitting here listening to the discussion and went to that section and started writing exactly that out. It would be on page 18. The candidate has been continuously registered for a political party beginning at least 180 days prior up to the time that it is printed on the ballot.
Right.
That they would be, and I think in that regard,
that would make it stronger.
Okay. Well, I'm asking that the amendment be drafted in that form. Yep.
That's a good idea.
And I agree with you that they ought to be listed on the November election, but if they get over 50% in the primary, they'd be the only candidate listed. We always have the opportunity for write-ins, of course.
Right, that would be the way. Now again, I think having always two, regardless of whether 50% is you know, the way I would prefer to go, but I certainly defer to your judgment on that. I don't think it's a killer provision, and there are arguments on both sides that are
right.
That are
and
good.
And, of course, this even if it passes out of this committee and the floor of the Senate, still has a long ways to go.
Exactly. You want to just tee it up as well as you can.
And, in fact, I will. If in fact that happens, I'll be going over to the House and suggesting that they turn it into a resolution and put it on the ballot.
And it also something, as I expressed the last session, I'm quite comfortable with. I think this is the biggest change in the electoral system in Oregon in well over a century, and it's the people's election.
And the people ought to have a voice in it because it is a monumental change.
Right. And I understand that why that's difficult now with the timing and not lacking an SJR, but I would be supportive of that effort as well, Mr. Chair.
Great. Phil, thank you very much. Anything quickly? We're out of time. Thank you very much.
Be happy to stay around if people have any questions.
Okay, Marjorie?
Sir?
Anything final for the group?
We'll keep asking about Monday.
Assume we will be here at 7 a.m. Monday morning. With that, we are adjourned.
Eighth Amendment.
This committee will
end. Probably.
I'm ready.